At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
I finally committed to getting back in shape. Hit the gym, ate clean, did everything right. But after 2 days, I felt drained. My body just couldn't keep up. That's when I found Stem Regen. It supports the release of my own stem cells to repair, recover, and actually rebuild from the inside out. Now I'm not just working out, I'm bouncing back. I feel stronger, more energized, and more like myself every single day. Stem Regen didn't just change my routine, it changed my recovery. Empower your body to recover from within. Whether you are focused on recovery, longevity, or just overall wellness, Stem Regen helps your body feel the best it can. Release the best version of you. Try Stem Regen today at stemregen.co. Use code POD25 for 25% off your first order. Again, that's stemregen.co, code POD25.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, looking for a whole new thing to be into?
Well, check this and check it out. We're the Sloppy Boys.
And we're basically like pretty much the new classic guys.
We were in a comedy group called the Birthday Boys with Bob Odenkirk, and now we're an indie band and we have a podcast about the drinks of the summer, like the Gator Bite or the Grape Gorilla.
And we have guests that are music people like Jeff Rosenstock or Stefan from the band Pup, or comedy people like Tom Sharpling or Mitch from Doughboys.
Yeah, dude.
We talk about TV and movies and music like Turnstile or King Giz, and it's completely kind of cool.
Ooh.
Give it a listen and check it out to see what you think. But don't forget that we're the new classic guys.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical social, political, and economic liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. The Trumpist right has a very clear picture of what they imagine masculinity to be, and are quite upset that it's not a picture all men find all that appealing. It's one of violence, belligerence, and professions of heavy labor. Anything else, including the whole of the knowledge economy that has made the developed world rich, is inauthentically masculine, the result of corrupting feminization. As someone who earns his living communicating ideas, and is pretty happy doing so, I find their argument unpersuasive. So, too, I find the politics of reaction, exclusion, and domination that accompany that argument quite a bit less desirable than a free and open and liberal society. That's what my guest and I discuss today. Toby Buckle is the host of the Political Philosophy Podcast, an excellent show that explores the intersection of politics and ideas. We talk about what men want, whether the story the right tells has any grounding in reality, the fundamentally adolescent nature of far-right masculinity, and how liberals can better pitch finding meaning in a liberal world. Reimagining Liberty is a listener-supported show. If you'd like to listen to episodes uninterrupted by ads from our sponsors, you can become a supporter. You'll get my newsletter ad-free as well. To learn more, head to www.reimaginingliberty.com. And if you enjoy Reimagining Liberty, why not take a moment to send your favorite episode to a friend? With that, let's turn to my conversation with Toby. In a letter Sigmund Freud wrote long ago, he said, "The great question that has never been answered, and which I have not yet been able to answer, despite my 30 years of research into the feminine soul, is, what does a woman want?" And I thought of that as I was reading your Liberal Currents piece about whether men want to be heroes and the conception that the right has of what it is that it means to be a man and what men want. And so I figured we could start there. We talk a lot about men right now in the political scene, what is it that men want?
Yeah, I guess to start modestly, I don't know, man. Like, I don't put myself forward as any great expert, other than the fact that I am one. That's basically as far as my expertise really goes on this. I should have got writing about it almost a bit by accident, in that I wrote about Trump, which is what I'm not going to say wanted to write about, but what I felt was important to write about. And then I kept seeing various what I call think of the poor men pieces. And so I'm going to write something about this. And I did, and it became quite popular. And then people were saying, oh, you have to respond to this Chris Arnard article. And I read it, and it was the stupidest thing I've ever read. And I was like, okay, I can have some fun with this. So I wrote about that. What do men want? I don't know, and I can't speak for all men, and I don't claim to speak for all men, unlike many people who write on this. I merely observe in this article that people who, usually on the political right, imagine a intrinsic masculine nature, a set of urges common to all of us, perhaps suppressed by liberal feminized society, perhaps an intrinsic desire to be heroic, to be a protector, to be a provider. All I really note is that pre-choice seems to disprove that, like empirically disprove that. Like, men today have far more ability than in any past age to go be a soldier or a firefighter or policeman, whereas past ages, class or hereditary hierarchy might have held you back. Today, anybody can do those things. And by and large, you know, with exceptions, obviously, but by and large, men don't. And that was really the only point I was making. It was kind of a negative point. I don't know if there's some intrinsic male soul or not. I really don't. But the people who claim to know seem to be describing a world that just doesn't exist. That was sort of the point in my article, and it was a much more limited point, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to this, because there is very much, think back to, was it the Pajama Boy ad was that Obama that put that out, like Obama campaign? But it was back when everyone was talking about metrosexuals, and
for health insurance or something.
It wasn't, yes, I think it was Obama, something like that. Yeah, but it was anyway. Like a very like guy in pajamas, not the Spartan warrior looking person, and the right went off on this. And there's a particular kind of story of what masculinity is, but there's an odd sliding between like a normative and a descriptive claim there, because I think you're absolutely correct that most men, given the opportunity to choose that particular lifestyle, which is very like, it's not knowledge workers, it's very martial, it is to be a man is to engage in like physical feats of strength on some regular basis that goes beyond just like going to the gym, which lots of dudes do, but isn't sufficient to live up to this conception. It's being a provider, but being a provider who provides primarily with upper body strength. It's defending, but defending in this, again, kind of violent way, or at least the capacity for violence is central to this. But there's this sliding between like, that is what men want, and then a like, that is what men ought to be. And so if you want, it's not just enough that like they think men want this, but they think wanting something different from that is itself a problem.
They're working backwards from the normative to the descriptive, right? They have a sort of vision of the world. And I think, I'm not even being rude about it. I think just as a sort of matter of fact, it's not a coherent vision of the world. Like, it doesn't all hang together. They want a number of different things that you couldn't realize simultaneously. But from that normative vision, yeah, I'll be an incoherent one. They're sort of working backwards to this sort of, it gets called biological essentialism, which is sort of just a fancy way of saying if you're born a man with certain chromosomes, you're going to have certain needs, wants, and desires. And, you know, a liberal society or a feminist society might try and repress those desires, but it'll only end up making you and everyone else unhappy. But no, I think you're right. I think they're working backwards from the normative to the descriptive, which all sorts of people do all the time. I'd also add there's an element of resentment and restoration. There's an element that something has been taken away, something has been stolen from you, which needs to be returned. And that's quite, there's a pretty old idea. You can go back to the ancient Greeks and Romans talking about how men aren't real men these days and we need to get back to real masculinity. It's also a very persistent theme in fascist thought that the world has become feminized and that men need to remasculinize the world.
One thing that struck me thinking through your argument was it's not that men in general don't want this kind of lifestyle, because there are some who do. It's not universal. But one particular group that I think does, or at least fancies this lifestyle as desirable, is teenage boys. That so much of the, you know, the media that teenage boys consume presents this lifestyle. The video games that teenage boys play are power fantasy video games about whether it's like Call of Duty style stuff or medieval warriors style stuff that is not just martial and violent, but like centers you as this heroic person fighting back against. So you're like, you're a violent protagonist in a grand narrative centered around you. And I think the kinds of things that adult men want are not appealing to teenage boys. You know, like if you described to 14-year-old Aaron what 46-year-old Aaron does for a living, he'd have been like, that sounds kind of lame, man. And most of us work, you know, because when you're a teenager, you just have kind of a different perspective on the world and what's cool. And so what occurred to me reading your piece was how much this is just like an adolescent view of the world and an insistence that men, the proper way to be a man to some degree is to remain forever an adolescent.
Yes, adolescent. To maybe even go one step further and one step perhaps more insulting to those who hold this, an adolescent fantasy. Because even within teenage boys who, I think, you know, no offense to teenage boys, but just statistically probably have higher rates of antisocial or low-level violent behavior. Not all teenage boys, of course, but probably like the average is higher, right? Even within that group, most teenage, like the army starts recruiting at 16, you know what I mean? And less and less 16-year-olds. Even as we talk about men drifting right and men increasingly buying into the manosphere and men increasingly wanting more traditional roles, less and less 16-year-old boys are joining the army every year. Like that's not something they're interested in doing. You know, we all like have fantasies, right? I think men fantasize about violence a lot. But, you know, by the same token, not every sexual fantasy you've ever had would you actually want to happen to you. You know, these are ideas that you have in your head. Men fantasize about being in combat roles. They usually don't seek them out. I think, yeah, it's a fantasy, but it's a fantasy that they feel has been taken away from them. And I think that's what it's actually about. It's not about the fact that men can't do these things anymore. I think the root grievance is that women can, that women now have opportunities that they didn't before and are no longer automatic social inferiors to men. And I think a lot of men have been conditioned or raised to find that really unacceptable. And so they both escape into these fantasies, but also use these fantasies as a political cudgel and as a form of aggressive political speech.
It sounds like there are then three explanations or attitudes driving what might be going on. And so let me see if I can articulate all three so we can dig into which one or combination of them is really at play. So one is what you just described, which is essentially a resentment that the range of options available to women has expanded, in part because liberalism made us rich enough that people, when you're richer, you have more options on the table, and women are taking advantage of that. And changes in social status and kind of conceptions of the narrowness of gender roles have shifted so that women have more options outside of the prior constraints. And there's a resentment that, why are women getting this expansion, but I don't feel like I am? I don't feel like men have gotten. So even if like the sphere of options available to me hasn't shrunk, it hasn't grown.
Let's just stay with this one. Let me try and put a bit more specificity to it. If I were to try and give the most, if I were to try and sort of steel man and give, I think, the most coherent and plausible version of what the complaint is here, it would be something like this. Gender roles are changing, right? From, let's say, the traditional, in which men and women have defined but distinct roles. There's things men do, there's things women do that are different, right? Men hold doors open and pay for dates. Women, you know, take the surname and submit to their husband, right? We all understand that. And then there's a more modern set of norms, let's just call it egalitarian, in which your gender doesn't matter, same pay, equal rights in the workplace. Maybe you split the check for the date, so on and so forth. I think right now we kind of live under a mixed regime of both. Like, sometimes you're operating by a traditional set of norms, sometimes by an egalitarian one. Now, here's, if I were to give the most dignified version of it, I would say, for men and women, if your life's not going particularly well, it's easy to feel like you're catching the worst of both worlds. That if you're a man, you're no longer benefiting from, you're still expected to have all of the obligations of the traditional set of norms without having any of the benefits, right? It can also feel, and I think both genders feel this way, that the other side is opportunistically appealing to whichever norm benefits them in the moment, and we're getting screwed over. You know, women, the complaint would go, want equal pay and advancement in the workplace, but they also want us to pay for dates. That's a very common right-wing talking point. Conversely, though, I've heard a lot of older women say, feminism screwed me over. I was expected to work just as long and just as hard as a man, but I still did all of the taking care of the kids and taking care of the house. So I think that is a common complaint on both sides. If I were to give it its most dignified form, it's that as we shift from one set of norms to another, a lot of people feel like they're getting caught between the cracks. But that's at its most dignified. I think a lot of the time it really just is anger that women have freedom and are asserting themselves.
If it is that transition, then it's interesting that the reaction to it, and I can understand this reaction from kind of the far right grievance type men, but even you get it from like centrists too, kind of semi-reactionary centrists, is not, we're in a transition period, and the middle point in this transition period is ethically complicated for people and socially complicated. And creates these, you know, getting pulled in different directions and tensions and friction that you've just described. And so the solution is basically an accelerationist. Like, let's complete the transition as fast as we can and get to this world where those tensions will be resolved, in the sense that we won't have the essentialism anymore. But that's not the reaction from a great many people, including, again, like kind of a lot of normie centrists. It's more, well, if we've gone this far and the tensions have arisen, we need to pull back. We need to slow it down. We need to shift our rhetoric. We need to restructure the economy, whatever it is. And they each have different versions of it. But it's not an accelerationist. It is a, like, literally like a reactionary response.
Yeah, let's, because there's two ways you can make it coherent, right? You can either move forward into full egalitarianism, or you can move backwards into tradition. I think, though, to be bluntly honest, it feels like we slightly confused moderns, like I say, in this middle zone between norms, whereas, you know, the ancients, you know, they may not have been very enlightened, but at least it was simple. Whereas I'm not sure that's right. I think every society is kind of in a middle ground with respect to norms. I think norms change all the time. And, you know, certainly while a feminist egalitarian set of norms is quite new, there'd been all sorts of different models of masculinity and the family throughout history. You know, I've been spending a bit of time recently with the how the Bible came to be written. And a lot of that is in a transitional moment between, like, ancient Near Eastern norms of the family and Greco-Roman norms of the family. Now, neither of those are liberal or feminist, but they're very different from each other. And so those people probably, and in fact did, we can tell from their writing, feel very conflicted and torn between two sets of norms and torn between two different identities. So, you know, what we've got going on here in the modern world, where it's all a bit complicated and confusing and we kind of have to muddle through, it certainly can be frustrating, but it's also nothing new, you know?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. And it's important, too, because there's a part of this narrative is there was a way that men were for all of history until the 1960s, or pick your kind of arbitrary date. And then we just deviated from this, from what had been the historical norm. But that historical norm never existed. Or if it did exist, it was at a moment in time, like pick a snapshot in an ongoing dynamic process and believe that that was permanent. And that's bound up then in, like you said, there's a fantasy about masculinity, because they've imagined a kind of masculinity that was never really what it always was. And then demanding we go back to something that didn't really exist and treat it as if it always did and was permanent.
Yeah. And I mean, in a way, that is just a microcosm of a certain type of conservatism, right? Like, I forget where, but the philosopher Robert Nozick defines conservatism somewhere as a nostalgia for a past that never existed. And yeah, I think that's probably one more iteration of that. And we've always had it in different forms or another. But the reality is the past is very variable, and there's all sorts of different societies and cultures there that it was radically different from each other as they are from us.
I think of it through Nozick's correct there. I think the other way to think about it is the philosopher Roland Barthes had his idea of myth, as myth is a way that we take facts of the world that are contingent and changing and non-universal, and then tell ourselves stories that solidify them and make them permanent, fixed, universal, natural facts of the world, such that then you can buffer them against criticism. Because if you are rejecting something that is a natural fact of the world, then that's incoherent. You can't, your argument is self-defeating. And so we tell mythology is the way that we construct what is natural out of what is contingent, typically for political reasons.
Yes. So the language I have to describe that, but I think we're talking about very much the same thing, is the ideological theorist Michael Friedan says that the core claim of conservatism is there is an extra human origin of the social order. So whereas the liberal believes in charting new ground and using human reason and ingenuity to construct a social design that has not yet existed, for conservatism, progress, or at least positive progress, is about reversion to an underlying structure or reversion to an underlying mean. That there are laws by which society runs. These can be the laws of God. It can be intrinsic gender roles. It can be a class or racial caste system. It can be all sorts of things. But there are rules by which society is governed that we did not create, that we can deviate from, but only to our detriment, but that are predictable and preservable, that we can know what they are and we can return to them. And this, in a sense, helps make sense of this paradox liberals find with conservatives, is they say, well, Trump or Brexit, these people don't seem very concerned with conserving existing institutions, you know. And the answer is conservatism is concerned with conserving, but this underlying, they believe, unchangeable social structure. And if they feel, and when they feel, that society has gotten away from that structure, they can become very radical indeed in trying to return us to it. And every language speaks to that. Make America great again. Take back control. It's always the language of return to a norm.
It's the palingenetic in palingenetic ultranationalism as a definition of fascism. It's the rebirth from the ashes of. But this also, this brings up, then, I had said a little while ago, I thought there were kind of three prongs of grievances.
I just took a straight down one of those, but yeah.
Right. But this, I think you have now thoughtfully brought us back to what I think are the other two, which is this odd. So one is, let's imagine you're a man who wants this particular conception of what masculinity is, and you want to embody that, live that, form your identity around that. One of the things about contemporary liberal society is the incentives don't push in that direction. So if you want to be successful in the economy, embodying that version of masculinity is not how you achieve it, because the highest paying jobs, the highest prestige jobs are not those kinds of jobs, except maybe you'd say like being a professional athlete gets you somewhat in that direction, but not many people can be professional.
Push back a little on this actually, okay. but finish the point.
So there's an objection that like the incentives in society encourage people to not live in that way. But then the third prong, which I think is related, is it's not even like it might not even be that society disincentivizes this. You know, like it, like the incentives within society might be entirely neutral on this matter. But because we are social beings, we like to be around people who like the same things we like. This is why like communities form around punk rock or metal, or we all like the same kind of music, and then that spins out into like social cultural connections and so on. If the conception that you have of yourself and your interests is not sufficiently shared, not widely enough shared, then it can feel like you can't fully embody it because you don't have comrades in this, you know, in this identity. And so even if society's not saying we're going to make it more challenging for you to do this, it can feel that way because kind of you just don't have that many people who agree with you on it.
Yes. So I see what you're saying. Like you're summarizing two further prongs of how they might proceed with this argument. Should we do the incentive one? Because I think in some ways that's easier to address straightforwardly. I'm just not sure that that's right, that society doesn't emphasize, reward, incentivize this sort of traditional masculine norm. It depends how extreme you are with it. You know, like like, yes, if you want to cosplay as an interwar fascist, then yeah, like employers tend not to like that. But like at the same time, there's different forms of incentive other than just the monetary. There's social standing and respect. And that, I think, still heavily favors the traditionally masculine. Now, again, as I was saying earlier, sometimes these incentives can conflict. So I would say, you know, as a man, like, backing down if challenged to a physical fight. I think there's kind of like a social incentive to not do that. You would feel, I think it's just ingrained in us. We would feel a certain sense of shame there, even if we know that's the sensible thing to do. And yet at the same time, a guy who goes out and gets in fights all the time is probably unlikely to succeed in today's society. So there's a conflict there, right? It's not always coherent. But I would say that professions like a firefighter, like serving in the army, police, even despite all of the fact that they've not covered themselves in glory recently, are still professions that are held in very high social standing. Like, people still say stuff like, thank you for your service. Like, if you ask what are the most respected and trusted professions in opinion polls, it's these traditionally masculine ones that still get the super majorities of the public saying that they respect and trust these people. So I think, you know, in terms of what's likely to make you a billionaire, excepting like professional athletes and so on, is probably not so much. Like, it's, you know, being really good with computers or something is probably you're sort of most profitable. But if you take a sort of broader, more looking at other incentives beyond the purely monetary, I think there's probably still quite a lot of incentives to be traditionally masculine. I'll tell you just one story. When I was in uni, I was going to a party with a friend of mine, and for whatever reason, he thought it would be fun to go in drag, you know, wearing a dress and whatever. I don't believe he was trans or gender non-conforming. He just thought it'd be fun to do. And this was in a liberal, affluent city, and the hostility was incredible. Like, people like yelling at him, I'm going to kill you. Like, and I'm toning down, actually, what I'm going to say. This was a bit ago now, but, and this was a big guy. This guy was like 6'5", played rugby, like, and still other men were having this explosively violent reaction to seeing him in a gender non-conforming. And he's like a masculine guy. He's got like a beard and stuff. So it's not like, you know. And like, this is the thing I think sometimes people forget. It's like, oh, you know, both people on the right who are like, oh, men have this intrinsically masculine nature. And sometimes people on the left who are like, oh, why are men like that? Yeah, why are they such, you know? And I think what both parts miss is men kill other men who they feel on performing masculinity correctly, right? Like, when I was in high school, to be, never even mind gay or something, to be gender non-conforming in even the mildest sense would be to put yourself in real physical danger. Like, when I think people on the, when feminists can be like, oh, why are men like that? And I understand that they're venting. The answer is because we get killed when we're not. You know, so all of which is to say there are both some positive expectations and some real, very negative incentives about men's behavior here. So I'm not at all sure it's the case that our society is incentivizing us to be metrosexuals.
Maybe a way to square that is kind of potential versus action. And I think this gets back to your initial point of like, men can choose to put themselves in warrior scenarios, and they don't. They most don't seek out combat situations. Most, there are some, but most aren't like running off to the front lines of Ukraine right now, even though you easily could do that if that was your jam. Is what they want is the potential to behave this way. So you sign up for, I lived through the 80s karate boom when karate was the coolest thing ever and ninjas were the coolest thing ever. And everybody was signing up for karate classes. And in retrospect, it looks kind of cringe. as
I think
the kids
that was
say.
just dying out as I became a teenager. But
it was an odd time.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that we actually, like those of us signing up for karate, actually wanted to go out and pick fights. We didn't actually want to punch each other in the face, but you wanted to feel like the kind of person who could do it. And I think also you wanted to look like the kind of person other people thought could do it. So this is, you felt like a badass in your karate uniform. And I think there's an angle of that, of the prestige can attach to like the kind of guy who looks like he could do this stuff. But as you said, like the kind of person who's actually out getting in a lot of fights, the status drops pretty quickly. Or the cops want to, they love their surplus military equipment and their bulletproof vests and all of this stuff that makes them look like badasses. But outside of like the weird subculture of police themselves, which is this incredibly isolated community, actually violent cops, their status declines pretty quickly in the public's eye. And so I think, yeah, we attach status to essentially saying like someone who could do all this stuff has higher status than the person who looks like they couldn't. The nerdy, scrawny guy who doesn't work out and so on. But the moment you take that potentiality and make it an actuality, that's when the status tends to drop away.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's all right. I don't have that much to add to it. I mean, this is sort of what the ancients and early moderns meant when they talked about honor, isn't it? We can have this very high, oh, the honorable gentleman, like a sort of foppy type idea. But I think as Hobbes saw quite clearly, honor is power. Honor is the perception. If you mess with this person, they have the capacity to respond and potentially respond violently, right? Like, that's what dueling's about. If, like, someone insults you, you have to reestablish your social standing as someone who can respond with violence. And I think all of that's still with us. We just don't have the language of honor and restoring it anymore. But that impulse is still there.
Why is it then that if being the strong, honorable, stoic man who you might look at and say, like, that guy could defend himself in a fight, that guy could stand up for those who need standing up for, all of those are admirable traits, and society has not devalued them, and those are accessible to, you know, you can choose to behave that way, and you can choose to, you know, not all of us have not all of us could achieve the physique of the professional bodybuilder, but all of us can at least go and get stronger if we wanted to. Like, all of that is accessible. Why is it then that, to get back to like kind of the right wing conception, so you look at someone like Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, who I think he imagines himself as embodying all of that, and he wants the military, you know, he's like, get rid of all these like feminizing questions of like logistics and intelligence gather, all the stuff that actually, and replace it with just like
a war.
Yeah, do a lot of push-ups and that's how you win wars. But it's always coupled with essentially like being a jerk. The stuff that they like marry it to behavior that then doesn't make them likable, doesn't make them admirable. And then I think when people don't like them and people don't find them admirable, or the teenage boys who say misogynistic things to the girls in their classes, they then, when people don't want to have anything to do with them, which is the natural response to a jerk, none of us like to hang out with jerks, they treat it as society is rejecting masculinity versus society is rejecting being a jerk.
Yeah. So first of all, what has actually been taken away from them here? Because anyone can go work out and learn MMA, right? Anyone can join the almost anyone can join the army. What's been taken away from them is women as automatic social inferiors. And this is, again, like the idea of honor, like the idea of humiliation. This is something we don't have a very good language for, and liberalism hasn't developed a very good language for. But at its core, and the ancients recognized this very clearly, freedom is both about not having someone above you and about having someone beneath you. It runs both ways. And whereas what we might call the Republican tradition, small r, you know, sort of the type of freedom social justice people might talk about, is the not having someone above you part. What they're concerned with is the having someone below you part. Having someone you can always behave badly to, always have a degree of control over, always humiliate. That's what they've lost, right? That's what they're in fear of losing. And it's not just gender. You can talk about that with respect to any number of other variables, but that's what's actually the animus here, right? I think the other part, and someone like Pete Hegseth seems like quite a clear example of this to me, is how much we are, people are just prying their brains online, and how much, like, just dog shit beliefs are part of this. And, like, you know, we analyze it as philosophers and so on, try to think through the reasons and the structure. A lot of these people are just going on and sitting for hours a day downloading misogynistic memes and rants and conspiracy theories into their head. And in their inner monologue, now unironically use the words like femoid and so on. Like, and, you know, at a certain level, it's a grift. Like, some people are becoming very rich off people buying into it. But on another, like, real leaders of the movement have clearly rotted their own brains on this stuff. Like, they clearly buy into it themselves on some level. And I agree, they've gotten to the point where any ability for self-reflection, much less self-criticism, has been vaporized, and everything is a conspiracy against them and true masculinity. There's no great story to that. These are just really dumb beliefs, like dumb and awful, and they will destroy your life as a man if you let them. You know, that, like, it's not more complicated than people who've just downloaded too much of this stuff into their heads sometimes.
Does that introduce the hope for a self-correcting mechanism then? That if you're being promised, you know, you're watching these manosphere influencers because they're telling you, you know, your unhappiness right now or your sense of a lack of place in the universe is the result of women or the result of minorities or your status. There aren't people below you anymore, and that's what's causing this. And so what you need to do is behave in all these awful ways and internalize all these awful beliefs and then make them central to who you are. And so they're selling you an ethical program, right? Like, ethics in the sense of, like, the beliefs and values and actions that lead to a flourishing life. But it's a failed ethical program. As you said, it doesn't actually make you happier. It makes you miserable and isolated and so on. Does that mean then that at some point this project is less marketable, that there's enough people who have tried it and failed that newer people become skeptical of it, and we move on to, you know, teenage boys stop chasing that and start chasing something else?
I mean, you'd hope, right? And I think what we can do is point out, sort of clearly and sensibly and level-headedly as we can, this is all I'm really trying to do in my articles, is look, I'm not even talking about what's right or fair to women. Obviously, that's very important. I'm just talking as, like, us as guys. This stuff is going to mess you, is going to destroy your life if you let it. Like, this will not make you happy or successful, right? And it's clearly not making the people, clearly the people who really buy into this are not happy. Like, if you think about the people who lead the modern political right, or the people who are influencers in the manosphere, almost to a man, I'd say they're clearly not happy, or even capable of happiness. So I think we can use them as a cautionary tale, and we should, and I have been. As for, you know, are people themselves gonna get to the point where they sort of think their own way out of it, like this thing doesn't seem to be making me happy? I don't know, like, it sometimes maybe, but a lot of people just seem to stay there, you know? I don't have a brilliant solution for that. You know, I think with individual people, you might be able to pull them out of it, but is there going to be some mass awakening where everyone just kind of goes, wait, this is all just bullshit, isn't it? I think it would be, I don't think we can count on that happening. It certainly hasn't happened yet.
Then what do we do about that as liberals? So last week, as we're recording this, I published an article on the newsletter that accompanies this show about how liberals have, and particularly like philosophical liberals, have really gone all in on liberal neutrality. And that it's what we talk about is abstract concepts like rights and autonomy and dignity of the individual and self-authorship. And then we talk about neutral institutions that, you know, are built for protecting those concepts and establishing pluralism, but not themselves playing any role. We're very anti-Aristotelian in the sense that we don't think the state should be setting out what the good life is and then helping you achieve it or directing you towards it. It is neutrality. And as a result of that, liberals don't tend to talk in the language of these are the virtues. This is what it means to be good. This is what it means to lead a good life. This is how you find it, how you achieve it, what practices are constituent of it, what perspectives and values are necessary to it. We don't talk that way because it would violate these norms of neutrality and pluralism. But as a result, first, I think there's real problems with that because I think liberalism, like the virtues and values and perspectives that lead to political liberalism, have consequences in the world. Like there's something that it means to be a liberal in your life, and those are, and to be a liberal is to be better than to be an anti-liberal in terms of the way you approach the world and see it. So I don't think that neutrality is like coherent. Even if we say the state should not be enforcing it, which I think is the correct answer. But bracketing that, what it means is that if you are, say, a young man looking to figure yourself out and figure out your place in the world and figure out how to be happy and how to lead a good life, which is something that basically every young man at some point is looking for that, then the liberals aren't speaking to you. They're basically ignoring these questions, or at least ignoring them and in the sense of talking about liberalism. And so instead you go to the people who are talking about this stuff. And increasingly that is the right. It's the illiberal right. It's the Manosphere influencers. It's the Gamer Gators. It's the Jordan Petersons who are telling you, like, here's an ethics you can live by. And it's an anti-liberal one. And as you've said, and I totally agree, it's not one that leads to flourishing. But it feels like liberals need to provide an alternative. We can't just point out that these guys are leading you astray. We have to say, if you're actually looking for this stuff, it's found in liberalism. It's found in liberal values. It's found in their application in the world. It's found in this way of relating towards people who are different from you and thinking about your place in the great chain of being. So I guess, what does it look like to talk about ethics and finding your place and these kinds of concerns from that liberal perspective?
So Let me walk through with you there, because in many ways, the answer to what do I think that looks like is my hero article. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do there, right? But to maybe rewind a little to some of the philosophical ground you covered, I think you're exactly right. I think, broadly speaking, there's two, at least two, ways that you could justify liberal pluralism. One of which is you could take a neutrality approach, and this would probably be most associated with the philosopher John Rawls, but you could sort of see here the governing liberal state as something like a referee between various different groups, making sure they all play nicely together. And while there'll be a thin vision of what the state should do, it and perhaps liberalism more broadly, at least in theory of justice, is not here to provide a comprehensive life plan for people. Now, I think, as you say, there's all sorts of coherence and philosophical concerns with that project. I think you can't put a neat dividing line between thin and thick conceptions of the good, and the very terms themselves are more evocative of a continuum than a dichotomy. I think there are many issues, for instance, you might mention abortion as a fetus of life, that it's not just that both sides disagree, both sides could not agree to a framework in which that decision could be made, right? So there are these sorts of concerns as well. But then there's also persuasion and efficacy concerns. Now, there's another way, which you might call comprehensive liberalism. So if you want to stand in for this, someone like John Stuart Mill might be a good one, moral philosopher, but very morally consequentialist. This is about what is good for people and what's going to make people happy. And instead of saying, you know, we're not going to try and say what's good for people, we'll just try and enforce this neutrality between them. You start the opposite way. You say, we know what's good for people. And what's good for people is making choices for themselves, is learning, is growing and developing as people. What's good for people is living in a pluralist society where I can, just as you say, you know, it's all very well to say you have the freedom to lead a particular lifestyle. You have the freedom to be gay. But if no one else in my society is gay, that's a pretty thin form of freedom, right? I need to see people living that lifestyle so I can model it myself. I can be in community with them. Right? And it's good for people to have multiple different models that they can think and choose between. All of that is good for people, and by having that, we create a society that will overall be happier and healthier. That's the comprehensive liberal vision. Now, there's sort of all sorts of concerns about that, of like, oh, doesn't that mean that you're telling people what to do and so on? What's the sort of limiting principle here? And, you know, Mill reasons that out very clearly. The limiting principle on that is the liberty principle, which I think is a pretty good one. You know, it's about you pursuing your life in your own way, and the limit is the ability of other people to do the same. That's the limiting principle. It's not some abstract neutrality. Now, within that moral vision of saying we believe in pluralism and development and progress because we think they're good for people, you will want to carve out certain pockets of neutrality, right? You will want to say, because we think pluralism is good for people, we generally want free speech. You'll want to do, but the it's not because neutrality is justified on its own terms. It's because it's carving out these pockets of neutrality can be a useful tool for the types of goods that we think lead to people having valuable and flourishing lives. And so anyway, that's the philosophical ground. To get it into the practical case, where do you go with that? I mean, I think the argument at its simplest is it's about, do people need to be locked into a single archetype of how to live, and will that make them happiest? Or is providing people a range of archetypes and letting them choose going to make them happier? I think that's the core conflict, right? And so I think our side of the case has to be, we as men today, it is perfectly available to us to be the traditional masculine man, to be a soldier or a firefighter. That is an archetype that is still on the table and that we can choose. We can also choose to be, let's just go to the other extreme and say less traditionally masculine. We can choose to have a sort of more traditionally female presentation. We can choose to date either men or women. We can choose, perhaps we have a role as a caregiver, as a parent, or caring for an elderly relative. That's something most societies perhaps wouldn't have allowed men, right? Or at least discouraged. We can choose between any of these sorts of archetypes and make them their own. And in all I'm doing here is I'm translating Mill into modern words. I think that's better. I think it's better because people are different. I don't think all men are the same. I think some men, it is good for them to be traditionally, to be a firefighter. I think that's what's going to make them happiest. I think for other men, to be a stay-at-home dad might be what makes them happiest. And I think they'll be better at those because they've chosen them. I think their lives will be more meaningful because they will have, they will be self-directed. I think that's good for people. And it's more complicated and it's messier and people make mistakes, but no society anywhere ever has ever imposed a hegemonic archetype on people as a gender role and had it meet everyone and make everyone happy and no one ever rebel against it, even the ones that are really brutally tried. So I think that's the case. And that is just my hero article, right? Like, all I'm saying is I think choice is good. I think it's good for us to have options. That's it. That's the bottom line. And I think you living your life, Emil says, pursuing your own good in your own way, you will fuck that up sometimes, but you will be happier in the long run for it. And that's it for all the philosophy around me. That's the case.
Listeners of this show are, by definition, podcast listeners, and so would potentially be interested in your show. So maybe close, tell us about the Political Philosophy Podcast.
Oh, yeah, sure. Thanks for the plug. So I've been doing the Political Philosophy Podcast for about seven, 8 years now, since the start of the Trump era. I interview a lot of people, political philosophers, but also journalists, academics, other podcasters. And I also do some solo episodes. So I actually did what I was sort of channeling there at the end, a whole audio essay a while back called Mill versus Rawls. That's why I was ready to go on that one. So by all means, do check out my podcast, Political Philosophy Podcast, if you just Google that. And I'm on Blue Sky these days as well. And yeah, I've been doing this for a while now, so there's a huge back catalogue there. Pretty much anything thought within political philosophy you can have a scroll for.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, looking for a whole new thing to be into?
Well, check this and check it out. We're the Sloppy Boys.
And we're basically like pretty much the new classic guys.
We were in a comedy group called the Birthday Boys with Bob Odenkirk, and now we're an indie band and we have a podcast about the drinks of the summer, like the Gator Bite or the Grape Gorilla.
And we have guests that are music people like Jeff Rosenstock or Stefan from the band Pup, or comedy people like Tom Sharpling or Mitch from Doughboys.
Yeah, dude.
We talk about TV and movies and music like Turnstile or King Giz, and it's completely kind of cool.
Ooh.
Give it a listen and check it out to see what you think. But don't forget that we're the new classic guys.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.